Thank you, Charlie. You have scooped almost entirely my introduction of Roger, which is good. He's grateful. I could lay it on some more. Well, the one thing that I considered one of Roger's great accomplishments was when he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame last summer. Maureen Dowd wrote a piece about his fiancée. He mentioned his fiancée, Peggy Moorman, who was here sitting next to Charlie in the front row. And that was very nice to see. She wrote a wonderful piece about Roger. And what none of us knew was that they had already gotten married that earlier that summer, a few weeks early. No one knew. And one other thing, Roger has had such a remarkable last couple of years. I mean, he's had 94 and a half remarkable years, but he also just in this past spring was formally inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. And one final commercial, but not really, Roger has a new book that he completed quite recently that will be out in the fall, right? Yeah. Inkball. And it is, it's the title piece, is the essay that Charlie referred to that appeared in the New Yorker. You may. You wrote it.
This old man, Roger Angel, all on
pieces. Can y'all hear? Can you there? I don't know if that's turned on.
There you go.
Okay.
There we go. It's called This Old Man, Roger Angel, All on Pieces.
So we have a plan that's already in evidence. Our conversation is going to be basically centered around a series of photographs. And the first one is, you've been looking at it for a while. It's on the screen. This photograph accompanied a blog that Roger published in the New Yorker, I think last spring. I mean, a year ago last spring. And he will read to you the text that accompanied it.
This, by the way, is not very clear because it's based on a tiny and treasured family photograph that hangs in my bar in New York, up on 90th Street. The ballpark in this treasured spring baseball photograph is a stretch of meadow or rough lawn in Bedford, New York, an Upper Westchester exurb where my mother and stepfather found a modest spring and summer rental in the first years of their marriage. Judging by the post-blossoming young apple tree just down the third baseline, this opening day fell on a mid-spring Sunday in, let's say, 1931. Since the photo is undated, I had based its time on the size of the pitcher, who was me, at 10 and a half. The batter is my mother, Catherine White, and the tweedy, cautious catcher is my 79-year-old grandfather, Charles Spencer Sargent, a retired executive of the Boston Elevated Railway. Not a great athlete, perhaps, but a man with a strong conceptual awareness of foul tips. I can't take my eyes off my mother. Her uniform, which appears a tad formal, is a well-cut suit skirt and a silk blouse, both in keeping with the Sunday outing styles of that day. Despite a certain weariness in her gaze and upper body, her stance is excellent. Her weight mostly over the slightly flexed back leg, her front foot stepping boldly forward in preparation for the swing, which will initially take the bat up and back, then swiftly down into the reversing pivot and full body turn that precede and accompany her speaker-esque. I have to explain, speaker-esque, that's the name for Tris Speaker, a great ball player of her earlier time, a great Red Sox star. Her speaker-esque closed stance cut at the ball. My pitching form is okay, too. Yes, I look more like a center fielder trying to cut down a speeding base runner at third base or home, but give me a break. By the size of me, I go about 82 pounds here, and the angle of my arm shows an instinctive understanding of the physics of the fling. Only the greatest athletes have this somewhere within them, an elegant je ne sais quoi that marks the Mathewsons and Mazes of each era and warms the heart even of the idlest, most distant onlooker. The photographer, who is my stepfather, E.B. White, has snapped the softball in first flight, only a blurry yard or two out of my grasp. And this good fortune, taken with a tilt of my follow-through, allows us to supply the invisible arc of the sphere, a combined heater and change-up that will parallel the lower profile of the apple tree and, descending, cross the plate hem high. A pitch taken by my mother for a call by me, strike one. Way to go, kid.
So we could talk, we could spend the entire, how much time do we have? I meant to ask that. How long are we here for? Someone knows the answer.
I think it's about 9 minutes.
What? Five more minutes? What? Okay, 45. We could spend the whole time, I bet, talking about deconstructing that photograph. But what really struck me when I read this, when it appeared on the New Yorker website, was what I've marveled at for as long as I've read your baseball writing, which is your anatomization of the mechanics. It's something that, whether you're writing a lighthearted piece or another longer baseball piece, you've done in a way that it's peerless. You describe things that for the rest of us happen just in a moment, in a flash, and it's almost, I've thought of it as a sort of Muybridge-esque kind of understanding, catching every moment of the mechanics. How do you do that?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the nature of baseball, which moves at a pace that allows you to, there's never anything that happens on a baseball field that's a mystery to anybody in the stands. Every moment is clear. Every other sport has things that happen that you didn't quite see and you can't understand, but everything in baseball is highly visible. And baseball looks easy, and it's a series of repeated motions. The pitcher pitches again and again and again, and everything that happens is more or less unsurprising until something happens that are totally surprising. And everybody does the same thing. The pitchers pitch, the catchers catch, the batters bat, and it's the same motions again and again, but each one is different from the other. No pitcher pitches like any other pitcher. And there's time enough, if you're paying attention, to see what the pitcher is actually doing, where his weight goes, how he moves, how he is attacking the batter. And the same for batters. I mean, every batter I can look back in my mind, because I wrote about them, I can exactly see in my mind's eye about 20 different batters of the past and their stances. And I think bringing this back is part of the pleasure of writing about baseball and maybe reading about baseball, because the notion that if you can get those little things right, what Derek Jeter does when he drops it, brings up his left elbow and the bat comes through like this. If you can get that right, the reader, you're with the reader, which is what a writer wants to do, is to keep the reader close, keep the reader engaged. And if I can do that, and the reader thinks, yes, I'm there, he's with me, I'm with him, then you're doing okay.
Well, I can understand that just from, as a reporting exercise, observing something and taking notes. But what you've done so consistently is treated every single, you refer to this, but every single pitcher's motion, every batter's style, as if it's a fingerprint, you know, as something as distinctive as a signature. And I wonder, you know, you have a reference to Tris Speaker. I assume that you really do see Tris Speaker's...
I never saw Tris Speaker. He means before my...
But in your mind...
My mother saw Tris Speaker, but...
Okay, so you...
I'm old, but I'm not that old.
So she described...
I just missed it.
She described Tris Speaker to you at some point, and you...
No, I don't think so. But the funny thing about, well, the funny thing about baseball, sometimes we talk about this at a different point in our discourse, but let's wait until Smokey Joe Wood comes up.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to move to the next image, if I can do that. Here we go. All right. So tell us what this is, if you can crane your neck.
That is a photograph of me taken in Fenway Park in, I think, 1988, something like that, by a photographer named John Weiss. And what I like about it is it tells more or less everything about me. That's me. My head isn't there, but that's my name is on my credential. I'm carrying my notebook. My pen is in my hand. You can tell what time it is if you turn your head around. It's 6:15 in the evening, just before a game at Fenway Park. And you can actually read my notes. And written in that notebook is the words Ken Coleman. Ken Coleman was one of the announcers for the Red Sox. And I needed to talk to him about something. I can't remember what it was. The funny thing about the photograph is that the crotch shot of the guy in the jeans, right behind me, that is my close friend Chip McGrath, former colleague at the New Yorker, former editor of the New York Times Book Review, a great Red Sox fan who was there that day. And I hadn't even seen him yet, but he later looked at this photograph and said, "That's me, that's me."
So. Everybody should recognize his own crotch shot, I'm sure. But what that really does tell is a lot about.
Well, we're going to talk about the notebook.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, I'm
that's
sorry.
What I'm
okay.
leading up
yeah,
to.
Well,
the notebook.
Sorry.
Exactly. I've received notes from you over the years, sometimes pointing out something that I could do better, sometimes encouragement. But you have a very distinctive handwriting, and I can, in my mind's eye, I see you taking notes. Now, are you a compulsive note taker, or how did you do that all those years?
I think I've always took more notes than anybody else, I took them in that notebook that you see is the Meade College two subject notebook, which is the great sports, really great reporters. Notebook. The reason I say that is that David Remnick, my boss, and a great writer, has used nothing else. We can't get these. These have gone out. You can't get them anymore. And Remnick and I mourn the Meade two-subject notebook. Talk about it constantly. He used these all over Russia when he was winning Pulitzer Prize as a correspondent for the Times. But the reason I take notes is that my writing in baseball has been sort of long pieces at different times in the season, and almost always was a late season wrap up of the season itself with highlights, and then the World Series, whatever. But I never knew at a game when I might want something that was happening at the time. So I wrote everything down. And when I was first starting to do this, and hanging around in the Red Sox and the old Red Sox Fenway Park old press box, one of the deacons or deans of the press box then was an old Bostonian named Cliff Keene of the Globe, and he'd watch me taking note after note, filling up pages and pages of notes, and he'd say, "How many takes today, Raj? How many takes today?" A take is old newspaper parlance, because after you wrote something out of your typewriter, you would hand it, and a Western Union, not Western, the telegraph service, would have a guy there who would hand it to a telegrapher who would send it to the newspaper by telegraph. So a sheet of paper was a take. How many takes today, Raj?
So they were basically, he was enormously resentful that you...
No, he wasn't. He was interested and amused. But what happened was I was terrified of these guys when I first... I didn't start writing baseball until I was in my middle 30s. And I knew a little. I was a fan, and I knew a little bit about the game, but I didn't. I'd never been inside, and I think wherever I went, the beat writers who were not as numerous as they are now, but the guys who've been around for a long time watched me, and then admitted me. They took me up. They filled me in. I was always dropped in. I was not a regular regularly over a long stretch. I'd come by for a few games or for some story I was working on. And without fail, these people filled me in and did my job for me, including Cliff King.
So when you're not a daily beat writer, first of all, I've always thought that that's a really difficult job because you're with a club. You have to have access, and you sense any number of times, I'm sure, over the course of a season when you can blow up every bridge.
It's harder than ever now because everyone knows what happens at the ball game. Everybody knows, and every fan knows.
Right.
You've seen it at home, and you've seen it repeated over and over again. You've seen replays. So the reporting has gone on to baseball writing, and it's all feature writing now. Much more difficult.
Interesting. Well, in any event, you would go whether it was for spring training or a midseason piece or, you know, during the playoffs, whether you sometimes were watching it on TV, sometimes you're watching it in the stands, sometimes you're watching it in the press box, but you then have to talk to these ball players, and that's hard. Especially nowadays when everybody is so guarded, when there's so many gotcha moments that happen. So what were there guys that you really had to work on to get?
Well, I made all the mistakes. I made the worst mistake, and this brings up a great tip for reporters that we'll now share with you, which was first enunciated by the great John McPhee. When you're talking to a interviewee, you can't be conversational. You're interviewing somebody, you want them to talk to you, and you can't go like this. You can't nod if somebody's talking to you, which is what I did. I remember with embarrassment the first couple of years, I finally brought myself the courage to talk to a couple of ballplayers. And a ballplayer would say about two sentences, and I would go like this, meaning that I understood, and he would stop talking. Not what I was after. So McPhee says, the way to interview somebody, you ask him a question, he says something, and you go, what? Huh? And you want to give the idea that you're really quite stupid and you don't get things. And then they want to help you out and they start to talk. And this is against every instinct because we all nod and we cut each other off because we get the point. But you don't do that. You just sit back and then you're writing while they're talking.
No, my way of expressing that has always been there's nothing better if you're a reporter than being underestimated. The person once they think you're an idiot or they have some kind
that
of...
That may be true for you.
What? It's natural for me. It's true. I didn't work at it, but it was useful nevertheless. And McPhee did that thing, and I have to do it now because I am going deaf, but, you know, where you really get them to repeat stuff. You're slowing it down, and you want to catch them, so all those things are very...
I don't think this kind of interviewing goes on anymore. I really don't. It's so tough. I don't talk to ballplayers anymore because once you get to the age where they call you sir, it's a big problem. It's not the same. But everybody talks all the time now. Everybody is online all the time or Twittering or texting, including ballplayers. And the idea that you were going to talk to them and they're going to tell you something about themselves that you didn't know before, or something about the game they didn't know before, is quite unlikely. And they said, oh, I've already talked about that, or you know how I am. And reporters are not held in very high report in respect anymore because they're not electronic.
But you know, you weren't always talking. I mean, you did pieces about scouts. You would get letters from readers. You did a great piece once called In the Country. You want to talk about what that?
Yeah,
that's really about the quid pro quo that exists between.
Yeah, that was a piece I wrote in 1981, and it came about because I've been getting letters over a period of months from a young woman who lived in Vermont, a poet named Linda Kittle, who was living with and later married a semi-pro pitcher named Ron Goebel. And she wrote me fascinating long letters about life at the lowest levels of baseball, not in any organized leagues. Semi-pro ball is played and it's all supported by local enterprise, or back then, and the players would have uniforms that looked like regular baseball uniforms, but on the back would have the name of the local hardware store or liquor store or grain and feed merchant that was paying for that uniform. But Belinda took the game seriously and invited me to come up and join them in Vermont, and I went up and spent a week with them, and I've never had a better time in my life. And they took baseball seriously, and I took them seriously. And it was so moving to go back. There was a baseball strike going on that summer, and here was baseball at a sort of a, you felt this is what country ball once felt like. I remember driving with Ron and Linda one day going to a game, and he got outside the front gate of the little unassuming tiny ballpark and he got a little folding triangular sign out of the back of his car and said "Baseball Today" and put it on the road.
This is the starting pitcher pulling out the
yeah,
sign.
Yeah, the
announcing
starting ball. Pitcher had the sign and said "Baseball Today" and put it out on the road. And on another time, I was standing with Linda, and she was selling tickets out of a roll of tickets in the evening, a beautiful evening in Burlington, Vermont, outside that great ballpark, the University of Vermont ballpark, beautiful place. And we were standing there, she had some change, and cars were rolling in, and she was selling these low-priced tickets. And then a car goes in, and she says, "Hi," and waves him by. And I look at the license plate, and it says, "Ump."
And she was the one who, I think, really concisely described, though, that relationship that exists between writers and subjects. She said, "We gave you our lives."
Yeah,
right?
Yes.
And you felt that always.
She said, "We've given you our lives." She
right.
told me everything about their lives, and everything about Ron's pitching and herself. And I was very moved by this, but it's my experience that if you're serious about your work, and if people think that you were paying attention, they want to give you their lives. They like to say we all like to give our lives. We take ourselves seriously, and if somebody is there who really wants to listen, tell some part of your life, it happens. It's a great responsibility, and Janet Malcolm has written about this in that famous first line of her piece about remember Peggy? But she basically said that no writers are to be trusted, that we're all taking advantage of our subjects, which is true, but in a way because we are taking what we want from a life. But I think the connection is understood, and you want to get to a point where you are trusted. People suddenly want to talk, and as a reporter, you want to get hold of talkers. You want to get people who
right.
can talk. And in my baseball beat, my baseball writings over a number of years, I began to recognize the great talkers. As somebody used to say, there are lifetime 300 talkers, like a lifetime 300, right. 300. Pitcher. And I named Ted Williams, Ted Simmons, Linda Kittle, Bill Rigney, Roger Craig, the inventor of the split finger fastball, a few dozen of them, and my writings are full of those same people because they talked to me and they were talking paragraphs. And there was, I think we talked about this before, there was one player I was trying to get. Who would not talk to me, who was Ted Simmons. Ted Simmons was a catcher with the Cardinals and the Angels and some other teams, an extremely intelligent, interesting guy who on the side collected American furniture to the point where the St. Louis Art Museum began to buy some of his furniture. I'm trying to get Ted Simmons to talk to me, and he's not talking to me. And at some point, I mentioned American furniture. And he says, "Hold it right there, Roger." He said, "I don't know if you know anything about American furniture or not. And maybe if you do, we could have an interesting conversation. And besides, my insurance agent had told me not to talk about furniture anymore." But anyway, I couldn't get him. And then finally, after months of trying off and on, in spring training in Sun City, Arizona, one day, he'd played in a game. He's a catcher. And he'd left the game in the fourth or fifth inning and was in the locker room. And I went out to right field into the locker room, and just the two of us there. And sitting in, again, I was hopeless. It was a silence. He wasn't really saying much. And so I offered a question. I said, Ted, you're a switch hitter. He bat left-handed and right-handed. And I know you're right-handed because you're a catcher. All catchers are right-handed. But you're a much better hitter as a left-hander than a right-hander. Why is that? And he said, why do you think? What do you think? And I said, well, it occurs to me that you throw the ball back to the pitcher over and over and over again, so maybe your right hand is too, your right arm is too, your top hand is too strong. And he looked at me and he said, I didn't think you would have noticed that. And then he was mine. I couldn't shut him up. He was, I belonged. I had suddenly stepped over some invisible threshold, and we went on from there.
Okay, we're going to go to the next image. Can you see that?
Yes.
Okay, talk about that.
This is a drawing that Saul Steinberg did for one of my pieces. I have the full drawing at home. It's in color, and I love it. It's I don't know if you guys are Steinberg fans, but just look that over. This is a Milwaukee Braves pitcher, Saul Steinberg, a miniature, not very tall, Romanian artist came to this country and loved baseball instantly and became a passionate fan of the old Milwaukee Braves. This is the Milwaukee Braves pitcher. But I love the tiny outfielder because that's the way we see outfielders from the stands. They're tiny and way back there. I love the detail, the little bag, on rosin bag, which says rosin. Salt of the life.
He used to watch Charlie Berry grew up in the same building where Saul Steinberg, he's his neighbor.
Yeah.
But he didn't know what was going on, which you do. What was going
on? Saul actually acquired a full Milwaukee uniform, a regular uniform, and he used to put it on when he was watching Braves games. I have a photograph of him, this tiny Romanian artist with horn-rimmed glasses wearing the full regalia with a hatchet and all this stuff in front. Something that belongs in the annals of American art somewhere.
Okay, next.
And Saul was a great talker in his own right. He would turn up at parties and talk, and he talked in paragraphs, and nobody interrupted. And he would say things. I once heard him say this. I love the accent. He once asked me about some managers of a team, and he said, Tom Lasorda. He said, typical Neapolitan gangster. But what is a Billy Martin? And I talked about Billy Martin, and I said that his grandfather had been Portuguese. And he said Portuguese. He understood the whole thing in European terms. But Saul once said in conversation, he said, there have never been any great artists who were tall. No great artists have been tall. Send your mind racing. How tall was Delacroix? could Titian slam dunk? But you were not allowed to interrupt.
All right, next image coming up. Ah, this is an amazing photograph.
We won't linger here long. This is a weird photograph. It's taken of me at some point for an article in People magazine. And the photographer stationed me in the middle of Shea Stadium. The Mets were away out in the outfield with a typewriter. And what I'm thinking while I'm posing for this is the planes are taking off for LaGuardia. They're just, a few hundred feet overhead. People looking out the window, and there's a guy sitting in the middle of the outfield with a typewriter. And the other interpretation of this picture is that this is the height of the festivities of the Roger Angel Appreciation Day at the stadium.
All right. Okay, I know who the guy is on the right, and I think you many people here might recognize the guy on the left.
That's me. That's a year and a half ago at the baseball writers' dinner. And since I was going, I was invited because I was going to be inducted into the writers' closet or corner at Cooperstown. And that's Sandy Koufax, who was the oldest player when the celebration came along last July. By order of election, he'd been elected to those 55 immortals came back, and he was the earliest one that had been admitted. And an old friend of mine is still in wonderful shape, wonderful shape.
Talking about last summer.
Last summer, yes, he was there. And I always wanted to get hold of Sandy and do a long, long piece about him because he was so interesting. And he's one of the great pitchers of the past who would still be a great pitcher today. And let's talk about that a little bit. We're going to move on, by the way. It's not going to be all baseball here, so stop fidgeting. I think we all sentimentalize the old players, the famous players of the past, and think that they're the greatest ever. And some of them are. I think Sandy would be a great pitcher in any era. Maybe Bob Gibson. Not all of them. What we don't understand about players of today, and even fans who go to the ballpark don't really realize this, unless you've got to stand next to a contemporary ball player, just even an everyday ball player, and see what's happened. These athletes are enormous. They are a different species. Derek Jeter, if you stand next to him, if you stand next to A-Rod, a giant of a man, beautifully proportioned. They are much bigger and much stronger and much faster than they ever were. It's true of all sports. And they no longer, so the illusion that was once prevalent in baseball for kids and young men that with a little luck, I could grow up to be this, or I could have been this with a little luck, because they were about our size, but no more, not the same. I remember at some point, I think in the 80s, I was in spring training. I was sitting in the office of Sparky Anderson, then managing the Tigers. And there's a huge portrait of Ty Cobb, one of the great, great all-time figures in the history of baseball. Huge picture of Ty Cobb, who played for the Tigers in a big cardigan sweater with a huge D over him. There he is. And I asked Sparky, I said, "Where does this guy fit into your lineup?" And he took the pipe out of his mouth and leaned forward and lowered his breath. And he said, "He's not starting for me. I hope he makes the 25-man roster." Not the same. So this is our.
We're gonna shift in a little bit from baseball to writing and editing, but so maybe we'll get to it then. But I want to at least broach this subject. You've talked about a lifetime 300 talker or a lifetime 300 hitter. If you're a lifetime 300 hitter, you have an excellent shot of getting into the Baseball Hall of Fame. So what that means is you have a failure rate of 70%.
Yeah.
This is you've talked about this again and again in your work. This is
difficult. Difficult.
It's a really hard game.
Yeah.
Everything about it is hard.
By far the hardest sport to play. Consistently, by far the hardest.
And we, in the armchair, you know, fans here, we're so quick to jump on these guys.
Yeah.
When they strike out.
Baseball looks so easy. It looks so, I could do that. It looks so easy. They make it look easy. But you take a great athlete and put him on a baseball field. If he's never played before, he is lost, completely lost.
Yeah.
Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball player of all time, perhaps, decided, really, with an amazing, gallant thing to do, that he wanted to try professional baseball. And he gave it a real shot. And he got as high as AAA. He was playing for Birmingham, I think. And he couldn't hit. He just couldn't do it. And last year, I talked to his manager then and said he couldn't hit at all. He just couldn't do it.
Well, it makes me feel better about my little league career, the 5 years. And four hits I got. Just one bad year there. So Roger, this is Cooperstown. That is you at the podium, And it's hard to see, so I'm going to interpret this a little bit. Far right there is Frank Thomas in the front row. And then
The only one is not paying attention.
Frank Thomas is not paying attention. And then next to him is Tom Glavin or Greg Maddux, I think. And then Tony La Russa.
Those were three great managers and three great players. Were taking
and yeah, the far end is Bobby Cox. And then there's Glavin. But Joe Torre is out of the frame here. And he was also inducted.
Well, I in my speech at Cooperstown, I talked about Joe Torre. He was my favorite manager, and I think. And when he arrived, I've known him for a long time. I knew him when he was a player, and I knew him when he was coaching, managing the Mets. And he had not had a very successful record until he arrived with the Yankees in the mid-90s. But the thing about Joe Torre is that the players really wanted to play for him. He never threw a player under the bus in interviews, no matter how bad someone was going. His standard answer, if somebody, a pitcher was struggling or a batter was struggling, he would say, well, Joey isn't proud of his at-bats or something like this, and or so-and-so is not happy about what's going on. And the insatiable mind, your family mind, would shift from the story of someone who was failing and struggling over to the player itself. He did that all the time, instinctively. And he had great success as a player. He was a catcher, and he's with the Cardinals, and was most valuable player in 1971. But the year he always talked about was the following year when his batting average went down by 90 points. That's what he talked about when he talked to the players. And then he would bring up a day in 1975 when he became the first player in National League history to bat into four double plays in one game. And they loved him for this. So I played with him. They play for him any time is what you heard about him. I'm saying that in the speech, and you go ahead.
I remember you talked about that in the speech, and I'm looking at Joe Torre while you're doing that, and he was sitting there going, nodding. Yeah. He absolutely appreciated what the point you were making about
Bob Gibson's in that photograph too. Can you see him?
He's in the second. He's behind La Russa.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he showed up for the...
Let me just talk about Bob Gibson a little bit, because what we don't understand is how fierce the nature of competition is in professional athletes, how they're driven by pride, not by money, but by pride. They want to do well. They want to compete. Bob Gibson, this handsome black man, in 1968... had the lowest earn run average of anybody in modern history, 1.12 for the year. And in the World Series against the Tigers that year, in the opening game, he struck out 17 Tiger batters. I was there. And I talked to the batters afterwards, and they said, I was awed. They didn't bluster. They said, I was awed. And we gathered around Gibson's locker. And you got to remember what the year 1968 was like in this country, racially, and what was going on. And here is this dark-skinned man standing there looking us over, and everybody's a little in awe of him. And someone says, Bob, were you surprised by what you did today? And he says, I'm never surprised by anything I do. Imagine that. I went back through the crowd of writers. I said, what did he say? And a little bit later, when the crowd thinned out a little bit, I offered some feeble, another question like that. I said, have you always been this competitive? And Gibby looks at me and he says, oh, I think so. He said, I've played about 100 games of tic-tac-toe with my 6-year-old daughter and she hasn't beat me up. And he meant it.
Okay.
Extraordinary man. I went and spent a week with him a few years later before when he was waiting to go into the Hall of Fame, and we became very close friends.
He talked to you and I think one other sports writer then,
He was hard to get along. I was terrified doing this piece. I was really terrified. Joe Torre was managing the Mets then. a great friend of Gibson's, a teammate of his, and I told him I was going to do this story, and he took me on the wall. There's a photograph of Bob Gibson and Tim McCarver, who was on the same team, smiling at the camera, and in between is Gibby, is Bob Gibson facing the other way, showing his back. And he said, "That's Gibby."
Yeah, he was, I know that he wouldn't talk to me when he saw me with a pen and pad in my hand on the veranda at the Hotel Otisaga there when I was writing about that weekend. So then we're going to advance this to this image. Whoops, if I can do it. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
People might recognize that, but tell us who it is.
That is John Updike at the age of about 30 on the beach in Massachusetts with the beautiful, completing a beautiful barefoot swing. Picture taken by his, photographed by his son David. And John and I were intimately close as writer and editor of all his, I edited all his fiction pieces for about 25 years. He had worked for William Maxwell, and then when Maxwell retired, I took over. And John died in 2011. I don't think the New Yorker's gotten over it yet. No way. He was our literary hero, our literary conscience. This enormous output, 26 novels, I think, 126 stories for us, about 500 other pieces for the magazine, verses, casual pieces of critical writing. This great, I wrote something about him, which is in my book. Let me read. Updike's writing is light and springy. I'll be a little lighter. I need more light. The sentence is fresh painted. All his writing, critical or fictional or reportorial, had a. The light is difficult to me. Can you read that?
I can read it.
Yeah,
sure. Updike's writing is light and springy.
Yeah, well, let me try that. Okay, here we go. Thank you.
I couldn't read past that anyway, so.
He's a fabulous noticer and an expander. He has invented HD. So armed, he felt free from the start to take up and engage with all the lay within the range of his attention and put it down on paper. As a contributor, he was patient with editing and pertinaciously involved with his product, an editor's dream. My end of the work was to point out the occasional inconsistent or extraneous sentence or a passage that wanted something more. Almost under his breath over our phone connection, while we looked at the same lines, he would try an alternative. Which one sounds better, do you think? Sighing, he would go back over the same few words again and again, then propose or listen to a switch of some sort and try again. All writers do this, but not many with such lavishly extended consideration. He wanted to see each galley, each tiny change, right down to the late closing page proofs, which he often managed to return by overnight mail an hour or so before closing, with new sentences or passages handwritten in the margins in soft pencil that were fresher and more inventive and revealing than what had been there before. You watched him write.
That's a fantastic description of something that is almost impossible.
Let's go in for just a minute, Mark. But I want to talk about what it's like being a fiction editor and what the editor does. I think there's a great misconception out there about editors, certainly among beginning writers who see us as monsters who want to change their beautiful stuff. And what happens with a long-term relationship with a writer an editor is an extraordinary intimacy which has to do with the difficulty of writing. Writing is the hardest thing in the world to do. It's just as hard as baseball. That's the affinity. That's my life plan, why I went going to baseball and writing, because they're both almost impossible to do well. It's really hard to write. Everybody knows this. Everybody wants to write. People retire and say, now I can write. That happens all the time. I often thought, now that I've stopped writing, now I can be a civil engineer. But it is hard. The first writer I watched writing was my stepfather in my teens. And I was up in Maine, and every Monday he would write the first page, the critical notes and comment, editorial page, to the New Yorker. And he closed himself in his study, and you hear the study, the hesitant sounds of his typewriter. And then he'd emerge at lunch, pale face, and wouldn't say anything much, and then he'd mail it off at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and he'd say it isn't good enough. And then the magazine would appear late that week or the beginning of the next week, and of course it was good enough. It was beautiful. It was beautifully written. And he did that hardest thing of all, which is to make writing look easy, to make it the flow of E.B. White's writing you all know about. But it's been a model for me, Updike's writing, a lot of other people, the baseball writer Red Smith. But it's hard to come by. It's hard to come by. And he rewrote the first page of Charlotte's Web 13 times. And you can, in the annotated Charlotte's Web, he's probably here. It's fascinating. It's a great book. You can see what he did, and trying to get it right.
Was it the sound of his prose, or was it the his work ethic that you think impressed you the most at that age?
I saw his work ethic around the farm that they had when he was a. He was constantly working around the place, and Roy Blunt wrote a piece about him a few years ago that said he was sort of a dilettante, which was got him completely wrong. I mean, Andy was a highly, highly talented farm handyman, mm-hmm. and in One Man's Meat, he wrote a whole piece one month about what he had to do next on the place. Now I should, and that's all over and over and over again, all the things he needed to do on the farm. I'm sure I've lost this right.
Well, I'm going to talk. We have five minutes, you think? Or okay, we got a little more time. I want to talk about some of the other writers that you worked with, because Updike was obviously a very important.
I'll say one more thing about this: that this connection between a writer and an editor is extraordinary. It's very, very intimate, because you are doing together this difficult and private thing, and the editor and the writer are trying to get the same result, which is to get something clear, something straightened out, so to get something better and better and better than that over and over again. And if you do this again and again with a writer, sometimes a writer you've never met, there are some of my writers I dealt with for 20 or 25 years or so who I never met, who lived in different parts of the world. Edith Templeton, for instance.
You never met.
But these were close friendships. And in a few cases, something sad happens, because when writers stop writing so well, or because we change or I change, you stop publishing them and not don't publish them as often. And this is the betrayal. And it's very hard to keep a friendship up under those circumstances. Some of those friendships have stopped.
Some friendships ended.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't need to get names, but that.
No.
But
I understood it. It's heartbreaking, but I understood it.
You obviously, you're not. There were William Maxwell, famously, was an editor and a writer at the New Yorker.
He edited me, and I edited him.
That's interesting. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And my question, I guess, is, I think. The editors I have known, I've been lucky, as you have, to work with great editors, and they are essentially egoless. The best editors, I find. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's not about you. It's about what's on the page.
Okay, so you're that's not about you. It's about the writer.
Yeah.
But then you're sitting here with your wooden boat cap, but you actually wore two caps all the time.
Well, that's right. That's right. By working, I never felt that by starting up as a writer that I could make a living as a writer, or that I would trust. I would be anxious all the time, and I wanted to work at something. And being an editor would came naturally because my mother had been an editor, and I'd grown up watching her with galleys and erasings and pencils all around her, and talking about Harold Ross over and over again. So it came naturally to me.
I'm going to ask you about
it's different going back and forth, and I think a pleasure. Yeah.
A writer in particular I want to ask you about is William Trevor. You edited him for...
Well, William Trevor was one of the great writers of our time, a British writer, a man of great reticence and enormous skill, and his writings have a stillness, there's a silence, there's a unbearably painful quiet things happen in his stories. He required almost no editing whatsoever, but he relied on me. He said again and again he relied on me. I was just reading them, and once in a while I would offer a tiny suggestion, and he would say, and most often as not take it at all. But in some reason, because I was reading him or taking him, there was, again, I felt very intimately connected with him.
Were you doing that over
there? There are other writers. There were writers. There are famous New Yorker writers. I'm not saying. Famous New Yorker writers who required editing. Every single sentence required some work. Very rough early draft writers. Other writers were pretty good, but the story was so wildly scattered. Mary Robinson, I remember, in their first drafts, you had no idea what was going along. I remember saying to her on the phone or writing to her one, I said, what are these two giant white horses doing here? And she said, I have no idea. I have no idea. But
I never met these people, so I'd seen photographs of Trevor, and I read his work. Now, did you edit him over the phone only, or would you?
Not by mail, basically back and forth. But he came here for a New Yorker festival, and I got a stretch limo for him. And he was very pleased about that.
One more that I want to ask you about is V.S. Pritchett, because I thought you and Gardner Botzer both edited him. Is that correct?
I don't think Gardner edited him, but he did a lot of critical writing for us. So I don't think it's Gardner, but. Pritchett and I went back a ways. I edited him way back when I worked for Holiday Magazine in the 50s. He was writing travel pieces. And then I inherited him early on in my stint as a fiction writer. And all I can say is we became intimate friends. A wonderful man, middle class, never went to university. His father was somebody who worked in a department store somewhere, and was famously unsuccessful. His autobiography, A Cab at the Door, is about the Pritchett family always having to have leave and pull up stakes and move to someplace else because they'd run out of money, and they were leaving a lot of debt. Victor became a reporter and a great literary figure. He was great by the time he died. He was the preeminent literary, they died around 2000, the preeminent literary man of his time.
Well, I'm gonna give you a chance. If you can read this, see if there's anybody on there you want to talk about. These are people you edited. If you could see that.
Well, Ruth Prawar Jhabvala. Ruth lived in India, and I edited her for about 20 years before I met her. She was Polish, married to an Indian architect.
You edited both Woody Allen and Donald Barthelme.
Yeah, Donald was a close friend, and suddenly began writing those extraordinary, absolutely, totally unique Barthelme-esque pieces that have now more or less disappeared. And he wrote Finnish copy, amazing Finnish copy, and he used to say of me, well, I count on you to get the hay out. Get the hay out. And I did cut him once. I remember he wrote one of his stories, which was very much like a collage of stories. And this was, I've forgotten what the name was, the name of some female character. And in the middle of the story, he used the word butter over and over again. He had the word butter repeated in about four columns. It'd be about 24 butters. Butter, 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 and stacks and columns. And we were going to press, and we were a little squeezed, and I said, can I take out some of the butter? And he said, four butters, but not one more. I want to tell you something about William Maxwell, who wrote about his hometown of Lincoln, Illinois, and about the death of his mother, who died when he was very young in the flu epidemic of 1919. An amazing man. I'm blanking out on somebody, sorry, excuse me. The great Canadian short story writer just won the Nobel Prize.
Alice Munro?
Alice Munro told me that she used to like to go to visit the locales of famous writers on holiday. She went to Oxford, Mississippi to visit
Faulkner.
To visit the Faulkner country. And she went to Lincoln, Illinois, and she felt she knew this town better than any other place she'd ever been, because every bit of it was in Maxwell's writings.
Right, right.
One more name here I edited was Louis Armstrong. And I edited Louis Armstrong when I was back at Holiday. And we got a travel piece. We heard that he'd been traveling in Europe with his wife for the first time in his life, not traveling with the band, just doing sightseeing, and that he kept a diary. So we asked to get it, and I got to edit it. And it was exactly like, I don't know how many of you are great fans of Louis Armstrong as I am, but it was exactly like listening to him play the trumpet. And I can remember one part of it when he had a visit with the Pope. He and Lucille were invited for a papal visit. And Louis writes, I can almost quote from memory, he said, the Pope asks, and he put in parentheses, serious, did we have any children? I said, teehee, no, but we was having a lot of fun trying. Never saw a Pope laugh so much. Then the next sentence says, outside he has Swiss guards. Another sentence of his, at the end of a paragraph, he wrote, going back to their hotel in Rome, he said, and this sounds so much like the trumpet notes of the beautiful way Louis plays the trumpet. Then we tipped on up those royal steps and knocked ourselves completely out with some sleep.
Wow. Roger, I get to talk to you all the time, but this was a great pleasure today, and I'm sure that everyone here shares that.
So. Thank you. Thank you.